This one is about content expression and the idea of the strata. I've left this plateau, that's plateau 3, to the end of the sequence on language, even though it actually appears before the other two that we've been discussing. It must have put off so many people from reading further. For one thing, Deleuze and Guattari hide behind a puppet spokesperson developing the narrative in this plateau. They call him Professor Challenger, a Conan Doyle character. The Wikipedia entry describes Challenger as, and I quote, a pretentious and self-righteous scientific jack of all trades, end of quote. Deleuze and Guattari obviously feel defensive, perhaps having been criticized for discussing topics where they have no actual expertise. Much of the discussion includes examples of debates in geology or biology, for example. The references are almost entirely in French. I found it difficult to do much more than just read through, hoping to get the basics of the argument. I've taken some more detailed notes on my website, as usual. I've given a reference to that on the transcript and all the other references. I must say I much prefer the discussion in Delander's book on science and Deleuzian philosophy, that's Delander 2002, especially the first parts of chapter 2. And these are a lot clearer, less interwoven with high-powered academic asides. That discussion in Delander mostly references Deleuze's earlier work, the book Difference and Repetition. While I'm here, it's always worth mentioning Guattari's book, The Machinic Unconscious, which is his version of A Thousand Plateaus, which has a useful chapter on language, especially chapter 2. However, the rest of the discussion is formidably elaborate. Guattari's book emphasizes Helmsleu again and the distinction between content and expression as before, with a bit more detail. Generally, the argument is that human language is not the only kind of language. Like animal languages, it is an actualization of the same abstract machines linking contents and expression. Human worlds participate in the same machinic phyla and planes of consistency as other forms. It follows there's nothing particularly unique about human subjectivity. Let's get on to A Thousand Plateaus. Plateau 3 illustrates examples of non-human forms of communication and tries to restore the role of content and its own forms. It also denies that human linguistic forms of expression are the only ones. Deleuze and Guattari cite again the work of Helmsleu to argue that content has an independent role, that it's not just exhausted by conventional human semiotic forms of expression, that it has substances and forms of its own. For that matter, content and expression are often found connected together in complex ways in actual communication. As examples, expressions themselves become forms of content for subsequent expressions, but there's also an argument that content actually generates expression, so that expressions are really better understood as forms of content. The key concept here is the stratum. Strata are found throughout nature and they are important in communication. Channeling Spinoza, Deleuze and Guattari say that, and I quote, "To express is always to sing the glory of God. Every stratum is a judgment of God. Not only do plants and animals, orchids and wasps, sing or express themselves, but so do rocks and even rivers, every stratified thing on earth." That's A Thousand Plateaus, page 49. Well, if, like Delander, we think of Deleuze and Guattari as offering a version of complexity theory rather than theology, that might make more sense. We can get to the underlying mechanisms of complexity theory, things like virtual forces, attractors, phase, spaces, and all the rest, by looking equally at sedimentary rocks, or at biochemistry, or at anything else. Incidentally, this raises the issue of Deleuze's univocity, the claim that being, with a capital B, always speaks with a single voice. And this is central to Badiou's critique of Deleuze. Badiou 2000. References in the transcript. So, stratification is a form of communication. First, in a general sense, that all communication takes the raw materials of matter and forms them. Human communication does this when it constructs things and words, to use Deleuzian terminology. Secondly, human communication itself depends on these prior processes where content has already formed itself into actual substances. There is a lot of discussion of these points with work in geology and then biochemistry to illustrate them. I've suggested the patient read through, and if you do that, you eventually get to three major types of stratum, which are outlined on pages 65 to 68. Let's look at them. The first type of stratum is composed of molecular and molar components, with molecular content and molar expression. The two levels can be linked by a term they use a lot elsewhere, but which I must say I still find a bit elusive. Resonance, that's discussed on page 64. They also talk of reciprocal presupposition, page 75. The molecular level still shows a difference between substance and form, since molecules can interact among themselves to become formed substances. The molar level shows both statistical aggregates and a more definite, and I quote, state of equilibrium. Expression carries the properties of the molecular or micro level to the molar or macro level. There are different possibilities since there are also intermediate strata. There are different possibilities since intermediate strata, epistrata, can have an effect. So can exterior forces applying especially to expression. So there might be cases at the extremes where, for example, the molar level reflects exterior forces as a kind of mould, or it can actively modulate these exterior forces, and there are lots of other possibilities. Well, that's all a bit general. Let's look at an example, and for me the best examples would be found in the discussion of geology and geological strata that this plateau begins with. If we think of something like a stratum of sedimentary rock in a geological formation, we can notice that there have been two processes at work. First of all, sand, pebbles, other bits and pieces are laid down on a seabed, and they eventually get compacted together to form a more solid layer, something like mud or shale. Over time, that layer is subjected to another process of organization. It might be further compressed, folded, perhaps even baked. And the sedimentary rocks around Plymouth, where I live in the UK, have been folded and baked by the volcanic intrusion that formed Dartmoor. So we have here a double process, one example of what they are going to call a double articulation. One articulation arises from loose collections of material, and one arises from tighter and more extensive forms of compression and aggregation. To use ordinary language for a moment, the point is that if you look at the stratum of sedimentary rock, it contains information. You can sometimes see sand and bits of material still visible in the rock, and get information from them, and then work out what's happened in the different stages. You can even eventually read actual visible shapes in the landscape, like hills and valleys, as products of the underlying geology. Well, there are other examples as well, including the ways in which crystals grow from seed molecules or seed particles, or the way chemicals interact in physical systems to form molecules of increasing complexity and length. We're going to get back to that a bit lower down.
The same could be said of the development of social strata. These are patterns of collective action among humans, including those that are particularly powerful in the formation of social classes or elites. Social strata are not specifically discussed in this plateau, but the sociologist Gabrielle Tard receives a homage in Plateau 9 on Micropolitics, pages 240 to 241. There we are told that in his great debate with Durkheim, Tard insisted that the great collective representations presuppose a prior stage, exactly what needs explaining, namely, the similarity of millions of people. There are other references to Tard's work in some of the books written by Deleuze. Latour, 2002, has a useful essay illustrating Tard's influence. Latour quotes Tard in describing social strata as composed of individual components, where the attributes each element owes to its incorporation do not form its entire nature. The collective power of which it is a part is only an artificial being, made only of sides and facades of beings. There seems to be support for the important role of pragmatics, argued earlier, referring to the apparent structures in language. Latour argues that for Tard, the structure is only one of the simplified, routinized, repetitive elements of one of the locutors who has managed to include his or her local tradition into the general idiom. Page 8. Deleuze and Guattari argue that Tard is not talking about human individuals in the usual sense, but rather about flows which connect individuals, such as flows of imitation. Page 241. As we shall see below, they also allow for structures to heavily influence actual individuals, as in the paradox of the subject.
Let's get back to ATP and talk about the second type of strata. Here we have a stratum linking organic and inorganic matter, or substances. The organic layer still preserves or even amplifies the inorganic matter at the molecular level, as in cellular chemistry. But there's one difference. The boundaries between the layers can become thresholds, and elements can align so that, and I quote, expression becomes independent in its own right. That's page 66. Different forms combine to produce real effects. Expression can take a linear form, for example. Apparently, they say, the nucleic sequence in biology joins together nucleic acids and proteins, and this is a crucial stage for the development of organisms. This independent level of expression means that the organism is capable of greater levels of deterritorialization, including the ability to reproduce. Well, there are lengthy debates in biology, both embryology and evolution, covered in this plateau, and again, I have to depend on Delander. I was struck by the argument in his book that modern embryology describes the development of the internal organs of the embryo in terms of initial collections of general cells, possibly stem cells, which are then exposed to a local environment of chemical flows, including hormones. As a result, they cross thresholds and go on to develop specific forms like bones or organs. Those in turn affect the environment of the embryo, which triggers other flows and other developments. These include clustering and folding of cells, once other thresholds of formation have been reached. This is in contrast to the old view, current when I last did elementary biology as a schoolboy, that there's some sort of blueprint which guided the development of the embryo. On a more general level, discussing the early formation of life, we are told that the famous open single quote, prebiotic soup, page 55, is a stratum composed of inorganic materials. A crucial intermediate layer, an epistratum, the membrane, further articulates these materials, producing a living aggregate. Here they describe it as a structuration, page 68, which is a kind of dynamic structuring process. In this case, it connects a living creature to its milieu. There is also an implication for views of the evolution of species. I can only be very brief about this because, again, my own understanding is pretty limited. It is not that individual members of species or types encounter environments which directly produce modifications. Instead, the species itself is the unit of evolution, and it contains within it all sorts of diverse potentials for development. So Darwin was really developing a science of multiplicities, they argue on page 54. They want to describe this as another example of an abstract machine at work, page 56, possibly partly revealed in a general embryonic form which seems to be shared at some stages by all animal species. As with all abstract machines, some potentials are actualized or realized while others remain latent. The plane of consistency regulates the development of potential, although here we have a tweak, saying that the plane of consistency itself can be reworked by particular developments like rogue particles, page 62. The discussion then goes on to consider a large number of concrete complexities and developments. Anyway, the formation of inorganic substances has been going on long before human beings occupied the Earth. Atoms have been forming into molecules, molecules into chains of molecules, chains of molecules into organisms, and so on. Minerals have developed in the same way, from atoms and molecules. Actual development can depend on the atomic structure of elements, and there are some quite useful ones, such as carbon, which offers very flexible molecular combinations, or the catalytic properties of metals. Again, I'm depending on Delander here, including a short article, which I've referenced, that he wrote about the importance of metals in forming up the substances that we see around us. This is a literal example of what Deleuze and Guattari mean when they say, and I quote, "The first articulation concerns content, the second expression," page 49. The third type of stratum is one that modifies the external world. This happens once expression becomes a matter of symbols or language. It's possible that this happened originally or possibly only with human beings, especially as human hands develop for tool use and human faces and larynxes for speech and gesture. Again, beneath those is, and I quote, "the cerebral nervous milieu," page 71. It has developed from the organic stratum as a kind of, and I quote again, "pre-human soup immersing us," page 71. The result has been both hands that can use tools and faces that can vocalize. It's this double development that underpins the subsequent important distinction between, and I quote again, "apparently irreducible categories, things and words," that's page 71. So both hands and faces together provide for a new level of deterritorialization, especially in particular milieu. Human forms of expression rapidly turned into diverse languages, but there are still limits imposed by the organic elements of larynx, mouth, lips and face as a kind of substance limiting expression. So there are complex interactions between organic, ecological and technological factors, and we could map them in principle. Instead, we get some examples. Different milieu produce different sorts of speech, and there's a marvellous and typical example here on page 69. Apparently, operating in a forested milieu permits softer speech than the shouts or grunts required on the savannah. The conclusive evidence for this is, and I quote, "everyone knows that lumberjacks rarely talk." What on earth can you do with that sort of evidence? This is reference to a French study written in 1933. With human language, we have a new set of contents and expressions, technological content, semiotic or symbolic expression. The ability to vocalize introduces superlinearity, the endless linearity of expressions which develop relays between speakers and listeners over time. It also permits translations, not only of other languages, but of non-human forms of expression. And it's that that has led to the scientific conception of the world, as they call it, page 69. All the characteristics of the other strata get translated into human signs. It's not surprising that human language develops, and I quote, "imperialist pretensions," page 70, and people think that human language is essential to any form of understanding or communication. This might include Lacan, and I think I've already said I think he has a good case. But we still have to remember that the biological raw materials that underpin human languages are themselves only aspects of an underlying technical social machine. And this machine has, and I quote, "states of force or formations of power." Human expression is also the product of the semiotic collective machine, page 70, that produces the signs on all strata. Both machines pre-exist human variants. Concrete machines on human strata can always be understood as intermediate states of the abstract machine. There's a tendency for human beings to want to see this abstract machine as something exclusively human, and this is an illusion arising from the tremendous deterritorializing power of human language. The particular social and technical machines in human life do develop a degree of autonomy, but they're still strata. However, only with human signs can the abstract machine fully develop and actively begin to write. I must say, I think that's quite a crucial difference. In what they like to call further clarification, signs can be understood as having three components. There are indexes of territory, symbols which deterritorialize, and icons which re-territorialize. Since all strata, including non-human ones, also show deterritorialization and re-territorialization, perhaps we can say that they all exhibit signs. However, there's no common system of signs, and they tell us on page 72, there's no pre-symbolic semiotic cora either, which actually alludes to Kristeva. We have to make sure that we're not seeing human signs as the only type against which others appear as inferior. Human signs develop only when forms of expression become quite distinct from forms of content with their own categories. Human signs can be organized into sign regimes, as we saw. There is still a prior form, however, including so-called natural codings, page 72, which may include animal signs indicating territoriality. Well, this argument underpins the lengthy plateau on the refrain, as we saw. So we've been through the types of strata. Let's follow up with some implications. There's some obvious criticism of the old enemy, which is structural linguistics. That approach has thought of the relation between signifier and signified in various ways, but none of them give any independent existence to the signified. This gives the signifier a high degree of redundancy, which means here an ability to be endlessly applied to an overlapping range of signifieds, and it's that that produces what they call its incredible despotism and its success of the signifier. Page 73. For Deleuze and Guattari, by contrast, there are separate forms of content and expression. There is, and I quote, real independence and a real distinction between the two. A form of content is not just a signified, nor does expression entirely dominate content. There is a certain reciprocal presupposition. It follows that expression is not just a matter of the play between signifiers. And they remind us again there are even forms of expression that do not have signs, and they mention the genetic code as an example. What usually happens with linguistic imperialism is that both signifier and signified are extracted from words. It's the construction of these words that provides the link. But we can see that words, like names, are never simply linked to things. We know this from what has been argued elsewhere about empirical things having non-empirical virtual dimensions. And when we looked at the hexeity, we saw that apparently isolated things are really better understood as something individuated from flows, still connected to other apparently isolated things. In this plateau, we have an argument from Foucault saying that an apparent thing, like a prison, is better understood as a form of content related to other forms of content, like schools or factories. Expressions like delinquency emerge reciprocally from this expanded content. It's not single words that we should study, but rather statements arising in a specific social field, a stratum, a regime of signs. There will be a specific history and politics to those statements. So, both expression and content should be seen as located in multiplicities. They share an abstract machine or a diagram. In Foucault's case, this abstract machine produces prisons, schools, hospitals, and factories. This is argued more fully, incidentally, in Deleuze's book on Foucault. Specific signifiers and signifieds are really formalizations, page 75. These formalizations can conceal important concrete variations, and for example, things like the actual semi-covert life of prisoners can be examined instead of the formalizations about what they do, and these can be cited in support of prison reform. Deleuze's book Two Regimes of Madness explores that, chapter 38. Specific assemblages, therefore, act to connect content and expression, not some universal characteristic of language. These assemblages need to offer this double articulation as described above, organizing both content and expression. This operates with regimes of signs and therefore with formations of power, and this is what Foucault calls disciplinary power. Now, for some reason, there's also criticism of another unspecified model of language involving bases and superstructures. It's not at all clear why this topic appears at this point. Maybe it just occurred to them. However, they argue that neither content or expression should be seen as the determining factor. To argue this would be to risk reimposing some hierarchy, lending support to a state apparatus before you got very far. Language does not fit into the concept of ideology. They do not actually specify who might hold this rather dogmatic view of ideology. I doubt if many contemporary Marxists actually did. Anyway, they want to stress that both economic base and cultural superstructure have combinations of content and expression. Marxism is not apparently improved by adding a bit of Lacanian psychoanalysis to develop some sort of Freudian Marxism, which is possibly a dig at Louis Althusser, page 77, although Althusser is admired in another plateau, as we saw in the discussion of sign regimes. Returning to more central points, there's a denial of any kind of evolution at work with the strata, although the early remarks on content being articulated first do look awfully like an evolutionary schema. The strata themselves do not occupy a fixed order, and they can act as a substratum for each other. And to take another example, technical phenomena can also provide, and I quote, a good soup for the development of insects, bacteria, germs, or even particles, page 77. On the plane of consistency, at the virtual level, so to speak, everything mixes. Elements are only firmly connected in strata. There's not even a dualism between strata and plane of consistency because we find abstract machines at work in both, located on both planes of consistency and the strata. The plateau ends by reasserting what might be seen as the virtual elements like abstract machines and planes of consistency. The strata do what might be seen as the concrete work to link expression and content, regulate flows of particles and signs, and manage deterritorialization and reterritorialization. All these are examples of double articulation, of course. The strata differ from each other in the way in which content and expressions are linked, and there are real distinctions between them. They insist again, page 81. Strata constantly subdivide. The machinic assemblages operate between the strata as well as within, and they also link to the plane of consistency so that they can effectuate the abstract machine. As a final aside, there is a fashionable development at the moment called post-humanism or non-humanistic ontology, which wants to fully embrace the idea that things communicate among themselves and with us. This has somehow been encouraged by work on quantum physics and the strange communications that seem to go on between subatomic particles. Barad is the one who's usually influential here, and she also brings in some implications for feminism. Latour's article, which we've talked about before, has his own take, saying that all this supports actor network theory. Others seem to think that plants or crossroads literally speak to them, that they not only have their own language, but can translate them into human languages too. I'm personally not at all sure that the work in Plateau 3 leads to this sort of development. I think the main point is to suggest that the same patterns of forces, the same abstract machine, produces both human and other kinds of language. I don't think the argument is that all languages can be seen as like human language, with pragmatics and subjectification processes. That would be another kind of linguistic imperialism they warn about. But see what you think.